I'm Jack Ledbetter, and this is going to be on The Fellowship of the Ring by Tolkien. And Tolkien's one of my favorite people. And it's very difficult to be in literature and not talk about him. I would kind of like, I think, just ground rules to find out how many people have read him and maybe who hasn't, just so I get some sense of what I might talk about. How many of you have already read of him or in him or all of him? Okay, and is it safe to assume that the rest of you have not? That's not, I didn't think it was safe to assume. You never take a vote and assume anything. Like when the CLC, when we vote for things in the faculty meeting, we get 75 people there and we get 29 votes, and they always wonder what that means. But they're afraid to ask. Well, then I think what I'll do is just talk maybe generally a little bit about Tolkien, about the books and what it's about, and then maybe we can get into some things, and I'd like the people who have read it to feel free at any time to plug in and say something about how it affected them. And people are fanatics about Tolkien if they've read it more than once, or even if they read it once, they still can be very fanatical. And there's a society of Tolkien lovers and all that sort of thing, and years ago it was very in to scribble hieroglyphic messages on the inside of the tunnels in New York, subway, Frodo lives, and things like that. I once taught at the University of Nebraska, and I taught freshman English at one class, and I was teaching Tolkien, and I would say something, and I'd see a hand go up in the back, and I'd call on this guy, and he'd say, "No, that's not quite right. This is what happened." I'd say, "Oh, thank you." And I'd go on, I'd talk about it. Pretty soon his hand would go up again. I'd say, "Yes." He says, "No, he married so-and-so, who was the elf queen of this kingdom on the second age, and they lived down the river," and on. I said, "All right." So I then hear his hand going. Finally, I called him up and I said, "Listen, I've read this book 4 times. How many times have you read it?" He says, 18. 18 times. So I made him assistant prof right then and there, and we team taught that class. That is, I would say something, and I always look nervously at him to find, is that all right? And he'd smile, and I'd go ahead. So it's the kind of a book that can take a lot of readings if you really get into it, and I guess it's hard not to. There are 3 volumes, and they're on sale in the bookstore over here. This is the place to read Tolkien. I guess any place is the place to read Tolkien, but particularly up here. Just up to Honeymoon Heights yesterday, and you go through those alders and around some of the snow fields, and you can just see Frodo doing the same thing, going through the old mines is like the mines of Moria, and there are just so many trails and rivers and trees around here that tend to remind you, I think, of Middle Earth and the forests. So I recommend it to you highly. Tolkien was an English fella. It was a Don at Oxford, a very, very brilliant man who translated in at least a half a dozen languages. Worked on one translation of the Bible, as a matter of fact, translated the Book of Job into French. An Old English scholar, probably one of the top 2 or 3 Old English scholars in scholardom, there's such a word. Many, many years ago, he sat down and wrote a book just so his kiddos could have something to look at, and about little people called Hobbits. That kind of languished in his kids' hands for years, and a few people, friends of the family, would pick it up and read it and say, "Hey, why don't you continue this story about Bilbo, the Hobbit?" He said, "Well, no, it's just something for my kids. It's nothing big. I got to teach my class," and he'd go off to Oxford with his robes and be a scholar. Till finally he did write this book. This is all one book. It's just divided up into 3 parts. And sent it to a publisher because friends kept urging him to do so. In fact, the person who urged him to publish it was the president of the company. Now, if you want to publish, that's the way to do it, to have the president of the publishing company ask you to send it in. That just rarely ever happens, but it happens. He said, "Well, I don't think you'd like it." He said, "Well, send it to us." And he was a very retiring, sort of diffident guy. He said, "All right, well, I'll send it." The minute he sent the manuscript in, the president of the publishing house went on vacation. And his son, who was stepping in and filling in for their father, picked this up, took it home and had his kid read it. He said, "What do you think of it?" And the kid, being some sort of an oaf, said, "Oh, I don't think as much." So the fellow turned it down. Sent it back to Tolkien, says, "No, it's not for us." Tolkien was so embarrassed he put it in the bottom drawer of his desk and left it there for years. And later, I don't know how many years, 8, 10, 12 years later, his friend, the publisher, at some party in England one time, says, "Say, whatever happened to that story you said you were going to send me?" Tolkien says, "I did send it to you. You didn't like it." He says, "What do you mean I didn't like it? I'll love it. Just anything by you will be good." And then he heard the story, so he fired his son. And the rest is publishing history. I don't know of any other book in recent years, maybe ever, that has gone through so many printings as The Lord of the Rings. It's published by Ballantine Books, and it's easy reading, and once you start, I guarantee you, if you get past page 100, you better put down everything, because you're going to be with it a while. Okay, so that by way of kind of general background, would you mind me pass these out later? Because I'll forget, and they have nothing to do with what I talk about, but I want to pass them out anyway, if I forget. Let me just read you, first of all, maybe one thing I could talk about just for a minute is the kind of a book this is. It's a quest. And I've always been a sucker for quest literature, where you have to get out on the road and do something. We all live quests. Every life is a quest. We all are after our golden fleece, our dream. And so this is no different, except that it's a different kind of a quest. It's not. There are epic quests in the C.B. DeMille tradition, where you are Odysseus-like, and you're like Jason, and you go out on uncharted seas and bring back the golden fleece, or you conquer this and slay that dragon and do great and mighty acts, and your heroic stature. And everything is big. The quest of Odysseus, for example, and you know that story, the Troy and the struggle and the war and the various islands he visited on the way back and arguing with Poseidon, and until finally it's just an overwhelming kind of a thing to read Odysseus. That's a quest in its highest form, perhaps. Well, The Hobbit and Tolkien is a folk quest. We're not dealing with Odysseus. We're not dealing with fall of Troy. We're dealing with little people. Little people who like nothing better than to eat 5 or 6 meals a day and smoke their pipe and drink great quantities of beer and grow things in their garden and watch the sun go down over Bywater or one of the neat names they have there. And that's it. And if you come to a hobbit and say, "Would you like to go on a quest?" he'd disappear. He'd just jump in a hedge or something. He'd just faint and scare him to death. They know what quests. Well, now Tolkien has given us this tremendous, epic, proportioned quest dealing with little people. So that's a folk quest as opposed to the epic kind of thing. There are some elements in a quest that all stories have in common. You have to have a hero. And in our book here, Frodo or Bilbo, these are the hobbits. And Frodo is a hero. He's a hero in every sense of the word. He's not epic proportions. He's a little guy, rather retiring. It's like in the army when they say, "I need a volunteer," and everybody steps backward, and there you are. An epic quest element is a long journey to an unknown destination. Anytime, whether it's Odysseus going to fight Troy, and even he tried to get out of it, you remember, he was masquerading as a woman, one of the first draft dodgers. But his great brawny bow legs stuck out, and he said, "Hey, get on the ship, you're going." There's a long journey involved. You're not sure of where you're going to go, and you're not sure of the destination. You're not sure if you're going to come back in one piece, but that's part of a quest. Another element of the quest is a folk quest is help from animals. You remember from fairy tales, fairy stories, there are always animals involved. And if you're a good guy, the animals are kind to you. If you're kind to them, you release a fox's foot from a trap, you bring water to a thirsty animal or whatever, and they are good to you. But you have to be of that kind of a nature. An obvious element of the quest literature is good versus evil. Sometimes in modern-day literature, sometimes those things aren't really clearly defined. There's great shades of gray. In a quest, folk quest literature, and in Tolkien, it's right and wrong, good and evil. And there's not much trouble telling who belongs which side. The evil side is represented by a fellow named Sauron, who's really bad news. And the good is represented by any number of people, Frodo and Bilbo and all the boys who go on this journey with him, with the possible exception of a fellow named Boromir who wanted the ring. And it's I'm leading into all kinds of things. Another element of the quest is the injury to the quester. Anytime you live on the edge of society, anytime you live on the cutting edge, you do injury to yourself quite often. Odysseus was not the same man when he came back to Telemachus and Penelope. He was not the same person. In fact, if you love Tennyson's poem like I do, you see Odysseus years later standing out on the crags, looking at the water, saying, "Come on, boys, let's do it one more time. You just can't go back. You can't go home again," as Thomas Hole said. In this book, Frodo is injured. Not a terribly serious injury physically, but psychically he's injured. And for all kinds of reasons, which you'll learn when you read the book, Hobbiton, where they live, is not the same. He's gone off in his quest. He's done the thing he had to do, like a soldier or marine or sailor. And you don't want to do it. You go do it, and you come back, and somehow Inglewood, California is not, or Seward, Nebraska, just is not quite the same. Another element, you have friends in the quest, and these friends aid you in one way or another, and so you can perform your task. But in classical folk myth quest tales, these friends fall off one at a time. They drop off. Say, "Oh, I can't go quite that far," or "I've got this to do," or "I've got to feed the cat, take in the laundry. I'd like to help you, but," or "I got lost." And so when you're at the end of the story, you're there all alone. You're looking around because there's the dragon with his mouth open. And you say, "Come on, boys." There's no boys back there. I always got a kick out when I was a kid watching old movies, westerns. Whenever the sheriff wanted to go after the bad guys, he'd always say, "Come on, boys." And about 40 or 50 grown men were compiling out of saloons and doors and all hit slapped leather, right? Or whatever they did. And I always marvel. I used to ask my dad, "Why do they call them boys? And where do they come from?" They sit around all day waiting for a sheriff to form a posse. But there was no end to them. Anytime he said, "Come on, boys." Well, we have nine people in this quest, nine creatures who are going to do a thing. And one by one, Tolkien, following the classic folk myth tradition, has them drop off. A couple get kidnapped, one gets lost, one dies, and they go off on their own kind of thing until finally Frodo and Sam meet at the pinnacle, really the cutting edge, and that's where the whole story really comes to a tremendous climax. But Tolkien, being a master storyteller like Dickens, has this tremendous ability to not lose these people, and the things they do are obviously related to what's gone before and what's going to happen here at the climax. So when it does happen, they all come together, and you're a witness to a tremendous literary tour de force, because he's handled all these things very easily. I don't want to compare Dickens and Tolkien at any length, because there's no point to it, but Bleak House has always reminded me somehow of Tolkien, because he has all these elements going on, and you're on page 520 and you still wonder, how is he ever going to retrieve all these things? And all of a sudden he's retrieved them. It's a beautiful thing. Okay, so that's the kind of story it is. It may help when you read this to think of in terms of the quest. Now, what I'd like to do is read maybe just a few passages from a couple of sections to give you an idea of why I'm excited about the book. And meanwhile, if you have any questions or you want to comment at any time, stop and raise your hand or do it, because this is not sacred. You have any comments at this point? You with me?
How many volumes are there?
Three.
And you're the first?
Yeah, The Fellowship of the Ring is the first one. The Hobbit, you can get the whole thing in a box set with The Hobbit. I think I would probably suggest, if you haven't read it, to skip The Hobbit and read The Lord of the Rings and then go back and read The Hobbit. Now, that's just worked well for me and worked well for a lot of people, older people. Kiddos who start right off reading The Hobbit and just go right into The Rings, that's fine. Now, I tried to read The Hobbit, and I thought it was really kind of... I just was really disinterested. Mm-hmm. But once I read The Ring, then I was interested. I went back and gobbled up The Hobbit. But they're written on two different levels. The Hobbit is, I think, definitely a children's book in various kinds of stylistic ways. Whereas The Fellowship of the Ring, there's no way it's a children's book unless you, you know, from 6 to 65 or 110, then it's a children's book, that kind of thing. It's longer than War and Peace, but it won't take you nearly as long to read War and Peace. Okay, hobbits. Let me just read you a brief description of what these folk are. Sometimes when I talk about I did a session once in San Clemente in California in a church, and I was talking about hobbits and doing this, and people say, what's in the book? And I said, well, they're hobbits. And I said, well, what's a hobbit? And then I try to explain to them. I said, then there are orcs. And I said, what's an orc? And I said, well, that's an evil person. Then there are fairies and there are goblins. And they, as soon as I say that, they just tune out. I said, I don't want to hear about this. This is for kids. Well, yes. Hobbits are an unobtrusive but very ancient people, more numerous formerly than they are today. Now, that's a beautiful stylistic thing, because it just relieves Tolkien of all kinds of things. If you can't go out in the road here and see hobbits all the time, it's because he just told you they're very ancient, but they're more numerous now then than they are today. So you got to get up at 5:30 to see a hobbit. And maybe not even then.
They live up in 10 miles, I think.
Yeah, they're up there. Oh, yeah. For they love peace and quiet and good tilled earth. A well-ordered and well-farmed countryside was their favorite haunt. They do not and did not understand or like machines more complicated than a forge bellows, a water mill, or a hand loom, though they were skillful with tools. Even in ancient days, they were, as a rule, shy of the big folk. That's us, as they call us. And now they avoid us with dismay and are becoming hard to find, see? So he's just reinforcing that. They are quick of hearing and sharp-eyed, and though they are inclined to be fat and do not hurry unnecessarily, they are nonetheless nimble and deft in their movements. They dressed in bright colors, being notably fond of yellow and green, but they seldom wore shoes since their feet had tough leathery soles and were clad in thick curling hair, much like the hair of their heads, which was commonly brown. Their faces were as a rule good-natured rather than beautiful, broad, bright-eyed, red-cheeked, with mouths apt to laughter and to eating and drinking. And laugh they did, and eat and drink, often and heartily, being fond of simple jests at all times, and of six meals a day when they could get them. They were hospitable and delighted in parties and in presents, which they gave away freely and eagerly accepted. So you see, we're dealing with really great little people here. They're eating and drinking and having a smoking pipe weed. And by the way, there's a pipe tobacco now called hobbit weed, which I smoke and love it. The last kind of person to go on quests. They don't want adventure. And who can blame them? Well, just to kind of set the stage, the book opens with Frodo enjoying the countryside, Sam, his gardener, clipping the hedge outside, tending the flowers. Everything is beautiful. And all of a sudden, a wizard appears in tall hat and cloak and bushy eyebrows and little laser-like beamed eyes named Gandalf. And Gandalf has been known to appear and then disappear at will at any time and at odd times. When you least expect him, he says, look out, because I'm going to be there. And he drops in on Frodo with piercing, bushy eyebrows and says, we got trouble right here in River City, in Hobbiton, we got trouble. And Frodo's dismayed to hear this, as you might be, sitting on your veranda, on your patio, and somebody knocks your door with big, says, we got trouble. Why let him in? Who needs him? But Mika and Frodo says, what's the trouble? And he explains what Frodo maybe had some inklings of, but had not really fully realized, that there was a ring, much like this ring, or any beautiful ring. It's all the trouble. He said, your guardian, your uncle, Bilbo, as it were, who used to live there, who has now gone on another adventure, gave you this ring, did he not? Didn't he leave something in your keeping? And Frodo says, yeah, I've got it up on the mantle somewhere in a little box. I don't look at it much. Gandalf says, well, you're going to have to look at it because it's bad news. And I'm here to tell you that the evil one, Sauron, is back. And a shadow crosses the sun, you know, at that time. Tolkien is not subtle about these reinforcement kinds of things, and it's beautiful. You don't have to wade through a lot of funny symbols. When Gandalf says evil things, the sky darkens over. And I like that. And it's imminent. Tolkien has a tremendous facility for two things, or lots of things, but two that have always struck me. First of all, his ability to name things. Those of you who've read the book, you know what I'm talking about. His names for trees and for rivers and for mountains and for people are exactly right. It's the kind of thing that when you read, you automatically say, that's right. An Ent is a huge tree. Or this particular Mines of Moria, that's exactly the name you would have chosen had you written it. Auden has a beautiful article on Tolkien and his names. The other thing that I really appreciate, and the language of Tolkien is just beautiful. It's a cross between Leviticus and Moby Dick almost. It's a thundering prose that just catches you up and just kind of whirls you around and leaves you breathless. Then at one point it can be very fragile and very delicate. Tolkien is brilliant with language. The other thing he does that I appreciate so much is he has his tone. Now for me, as a poet, tone is everything. I think tone is maybe the most important thing. He has a tremendous tone, and his tone is one thing I like is of imminent danger. There's almost always something about to occur in Tolkien, and it leaves you kind of looking over your shoulder to see what's like Satchel Paige, you know, the old black baseball pitcher who pitched until he was God knows how old, right? And somebody asked him, how do you do it? They said, what's your philosophy, Satch? How do you go on? You're pitching major league ball at 49 years old. He says, I got one philosophy. He says, never look back, because something might be gaining on you. And that's Tolkien's philosophy. Okay. So Gandalf persuades him that ring is bad. It came from a bad source. It's got to be destroyed. Get rid of it. And Frodo says, well, I don't know, I kind of hate to do that, I always fancy that ring. Don't put it on, Gandalf says, you'll become invisible. It makes you invisible and it does bad things to your body. So leave it alone, don't touch it. The evil one is looking for it, and I think he knows it's right here in Hobbiton. Now, if Sauron sends out all the bad guys and comes down on this village, all your cronies are going to get wiped out. You don't want that to happen, do you? He starts laying this heavy stuff on poor Frodo. Frodo says, no, I don't want that here. You want it? And Gandalf says, no, it's yours. I think you've got to dispense with it. And that's the beginning of the quest. And Frodo says, well, what do I do with it? And Gandalf says, well, there's only one thing you can do with it. You must take it to where it was forged in the cracks of Doom, this huge volcano in the bad lands 1,875 miles away, and drop it in there. Or that's what has to be done to it anyway. Frodo says, wow. That'd take quite a journey, wouldn't it? Gandalf looks right at him and says, well, you better get started. So Frodo, to make a long story short, he's in a few days, he gets his pack together. I love, they're always putting on a pack and leaping over a small hedge. They're always disappearing in the grass. And Tolkien always has these guys disappearing. And the hedges must have been very small because these guys were very small. And outside where Sam, the faithful gardener, was pruning things, that suddenly has stopped, and Gandalf spies him out there and knows he's been eavesdropping, so he reaches out, snatches him in, and says, Samwise, I'm going to turn you into a toad for listening to that. And he begs Mr. Frodo to have mercy on him, intercede with Gandalf. And so finally it's agreed that they will go together. And then Merry and Pippin, two other hobbits, find out about it, and pretty soon there's quite a party on the way. And the quest begins with that kind of a thing. And even here, it's different. Most quests, you know, you go after something with the Golden Fleece or whatever it is you have to bring back. This quest, you have to take something out and leave it, destroy it. Okay, so they're on the way, and you know what hobbits look like, and you know they don't like these kinds of journeys, but they've got to do it anyway. And they're maybe they've gotten as far as, maybe Lyman Lake or even up to Cloudy, and they look back if they can still see the village, and they don't like to get out of their village. So let me read you this section. A mile or two further south, they hastily crossed the great road from the Brandywine Bridge. They were now in the Took Land, and bending southeastwards, they made for the Green Hill Country. As they began to climb its first slopes, they looked back and saw the lamps in Hobbiton far off twinkling in the gentle valley of the water. Soon it disappeared in the folds of the darkened land, and was followed by Bywater beside its gray pool. When the light of the last farm was far behind, peeping among the trees, Frodo turned and waved a hand in farewell. I wonder if I shall ever look down into that valley again, he said quietly. That's another thing that Tolkien does very nicely. Being an excellent writer, he'll set the beautiful stage and then maybe have a little dialogue, but he doesn't nail his thumb to the door with the theses. He just says what he's going to say and then gets off of it and lets you... He creates a lot of aesthetic distance. He doesn't overwrite. When they had walked for about 3 hours, they rested. The night was clear, cool, and starry. that smoke like wisps of mist were creeping up the hillsides from the streams and deep meadows. Thin-clad birches swaying in light wind above their heads made a black net against the pale sky. They ate a very frugal supper for hobbits, and then went on again. Soon they struck a narrow road that went rolling up and down, fading away into the darkness ahead. The road to Woodhall and Stock and the Buckleberry Ferry. It climbed away from the main road in the water valley and wound over the skirts of the green hills towards Woody End, a wild corner of the East Farthing. So you get into that spirit and that flavor of Tolkien and the names of things, the names of little trees and flowers and woods, until you, with Tolkien, are off on your journey. Almost immediately, however, you have this sense of imminent danger because the Black Riders, these wraith-like ring wraiths, are after Frodo because they have been advised that the ring has gone. It's out of Hobbiton, and Sauron has sent his cronies out after it. So Frodo, they're along the road, and Frodo says, "What's that? I hear something." He looks back, and here's a horse coming. Now Gandalf has told him that this ring you're bearing is strong medicine, so if somebody comes after you, don't wait around to find out what they want. Get out of sight till you know. So they jump into the bushes and the trees as this rider approaches. Frodo dived under a tree. The other two ran quickly to the left and down into a little hollow not far from the road. There they lay flat. Frodo hesitated for a second. Curiosity or some other feeling was struggling with his desire to hide. The sound of hooves drew nearer. Just in time, he threw himself down in a patch of long grass behind a tree that overshadowed the road. Then he lifted his head and peered cautiously above one of the great roots. Round the corner came a black horse, no hobbit pony, but a full-sized horse, and on it sat a large man, who seemed to crouch in the saddle, wrapped in a great black cloak and hood, so that only his boots and the high stirrup showed below. His face was shadowed and invisible. When it reached the tree and was level with Frodo, the horse stopped. The riding figure sat quite still, with its head bowed, as if listening. From inside the hood came a noise as of someone sniffing to catch an elusive scent. The head turned from side to side of the road. A sudden, unreasoning fear of discovery laid hold of Frodo, and he thought of his ring. He hardly dared to breathe, and yet the desire to get it out of his pocket became so strong that he began to slowly move his hand. The advice of Gandalf seemed absurd. Bilbo had used the ring, and I'm still in the Shire, he thought, as his hand touched the chain on which it hung. At that moment, the rider sat up and shook the reins. The horse stepped forward, walking slowly at first, and then breaking into a quick trot. Frodo crawled to the edge of the road and watched the rider until he dwindled into the distance. He could not be quite sure, but it seemed to him that suddenly before it passed out of sight, the horse turned aside and went into the trees on the right. So there we have one of the first encounters with the powers of darkness. Again, Tolkien is doing something stylistically, which I think is really neat, that the horse stops. There's not a confrontation. The rider sniffs out from under this black hood, but nothing happens. But it's the power, the imminent danger that attracts you. And then the horse goes on, but he just doesn't disappear. He turns into the woods on the right. Now that sets you up psychically for saying, oh, he's not gone out of sight. He's going to be around the next bend. Tolkien does this over and over and over, very delicately, I think. Always leaves you hanging. It's great formula literature if you want to get crass about it, but it's really much, much better than that. I shouldn't even have said that. Okay, comments. From those of you who have read, want to say something at this point about what's happening.
Are the bad guys hobbit-sized?
No.
No, the bad guys are really, there are nine of them, these black riders, dark riders, and they are ex-kings and princesses of countries. They're royalty.
They're human-sized?
Yeah. They have been ensnared by the ring. There are several rings. There's some background there. And Sauron has seen to it that several people of eminence and importance have got these rings, and they have become enslaved to him, and they have disappeared. They've died, and they have some kind of unhuman shape inside the hood.
Seven for the elves and three for the men and one for the dark one or something like that.
Yeah. There, elves have had some rings.
Seven for the dwarves and three for the...
Yeah.
There you go. All right, the dwarves have seven, and three of them are still around, and the dragons have eaten four of them, right?
Mm-hmm. And the three still
Yeah, and there are three others still around. And there's several rings, in other words. But the one ring, the one Sauron has lost, he wants to get back very badly. Because once he has that back, the rest of them are his to command, see? And he's got to get this ring back. And how he lost the ring is another interesting story, which you kind of get in The Hobbit, which I won't go into now, but it's kind of a neat story. That's where Gollum comes in. Gollum is a tremendous character. Well, on this journey, they stop at a town called Bree, and Motel 6, and at the Prancing Pony, right? Uh-huh. Which is the sign hanging outside the snack bar. Isn't that right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it used to be called the Prancing Pony. And there they meet a fellow. Suddenly Frodo noticed that a strange-looking, weather-beaten man sitting in the shadows near the wall was also listening intently to the Hobbit talk. He had a tall tankard in front of him and was smoking a long-stemmed pipe, curiously carved. His legs were stretched out before him, showing high boots of supple leather that fitted him well, but had seen much wear and were now caked with mud. His legs were stretched out before him, showing high boots of supple leather that fitted him well, but had seen much wear and were now caked with mud. A travel-stained cloak of heavy dark green cloth was drawn close about him, and in spite of the heat of the room, he wore a hood that overshadowed his face, but the gleam of his eyes could be seen as he watched the hobbits. "Who's that?" Frodo asked. "Well, that's Strider, a man we'll call Strider, who turns out to be all kinds of interesting people, all rolled up in one. And he knows that the ring is going. He knows this journey, and he is meeting these guys, the hobbits, and he gets them aside and says, 'Listen, I can take you where you want to go.' And he's got this huge hood on. He's very tall, very gaunt-looking, smoking this curiously carved pipe, which I think is tremendous. He doesn't explain what the symbols are. It's just curiously carved. So that should grab your interest. And these poor little hobbits looking up into this cave of this man, very distrustful. It turns out he's a very, very fine guy, and he's Strider because he strides all over the wilderness, and he and his clan have really been seeing to it that things are rather safe in Hobbiton. They keep danger out of the Shire, and now he's going to take them on a little further in their journey. Strider. The journey, the first place they go is a place called where Elrond lives, Rivendell. Elrond is a half-elf, and some elves live there. It's a beautiful place, not unlike Shangri-La, where once you're in the valley, birds are singing, the sky is perpetually blue, and running water is clear and all that. But there's some danger on the way. So they have to camp at a place called Weathertop. It's a kind of a little mountain. And they're very tired. And Strider, who has been accepted now by the hobbits, feels very uneasy about this place. And so they build a small fire, and this is what happens. "I was too careless on the hilltop," answered Strider. "I was very anxious to find some sign of Gandalf, but it was a mistake for three of us to go up and stand there so long. For the black horses can see, and the riders can use men and other creatures as spies, as we found at Bree. They themselves do not see the world of light as we do, but our shapes cast shadows in their minds." That's a beautiful description. Our shapes cast shadows in their mind. So now they're all scared to death. Strider's told them, "I think we're going to have it right here." So then they stand up and they sing. They're always singing these great epic songs. The poems throughout are tremendous. But you sometimes wonder if it might not be prudent to be quiet if you know danger is lurking. But they stand up, take a deep breath like Nelson Eddy, and sing across. So all these black shapes who are seeing their shadows in their mind or whatever are following that. All of a sudden, Frodo jumps up. Did you see something? Ask Frodo, springing to his feet. No, sir, I saw nothing. I didn't stop to look, says Sam. I saw something, said Mary, or I thought I did, away westwards where the moonlight was falling on the flats beyond the shadow of the hilltops. I thought there were two or three black shapes. They seemed to be moving this way. Well, naturally, that's stylistic. They would be moving this way. It wouldn't be fun to say they're moving. Who cares if they're moving away? That's like a door is ajar. It's always, you never see a closed door. It's always ajar. Keep close to the fire with your faces outward, cried Strider. Get some of the longer sticks ready in your hands. For a breathless time, they stood there silent and alert, with their backs turned to the wood fire, each gazing into the shadows that encircled them. Nothing happened. There was no sound or movement in the night. Frodo stirred, feeling that he must break the silence. He longed to shout out loud. Hush, whispered Strider. What's that? Gasped Pippin at the same moment. Over the lip of the little dell on the far side, away from the hill, they felt, rather than saw, a shadow rise. One shadow, or more than one. They strained their eyes, and the shadow seemed to grow. Soon there could be no doubt. Three or four tall black figures were standing there on the slope, looking down on them. So black were they that they seemed like black holes in the deep shade behind them. Frodo thought that he heard a faint hiss as a venomous breath and felt a thin, piercing chill. Then the shapes slowly advanced. And I was going to make a comment, but I got to read this next line. Terror overcame Pippin and Merry, and they threw themselves flat on the ground. They're doing this throughout the entire trilogy. When they get scared, they just fall flat on the ground. They're great warriors. Except in the last book, they are indeed great warriors. They join various kings and do yeoman's or knightly service in behalf of one king or another. But for now, they just fall flat. Tolkien's doing this sense of imminent danger I talked about is really, you can see that hill here. They just don't come charging over as a B Hollywood Western and do battle. They suddenly appear at the lip of the dell and just stand there. Dark holes in the black night. And you're allowed to deal with that psychically and imagine what that terror is. And after you've imagined a while, then they slowly advance. That's much nicer than just down in the fight and that's it, which is what a hack writer probably would have done with that. This is brilliantly done. Well, in this skirmish, Frodo is stabbed in the shoulder with one of the knives. And, well, let me read you this. Immediately, though everything else remained as before, dim and dark, the shape, oh, I know, I forgot something, right? Frodo put on the ring. Couldn't resist anymore. As soon as he put on the ring, everything else remained as before, dim and dark. The shapes became terribly clear. Now Frodo, it has some link with these things. He was able to see beneath their black wrappings. There were five tall figures, two standing on the lip of the dell, three advancing. In their white faces burned keen and merciless eyes. Under their mantles were long gray robes. Upon their gray hairs were helms of silver. In their haggard hands were swords of steel. Their eyes fell on him and pierced him as they rushed toward him. Desperate, he drew his own sword, and it seemed to him that it flickered red as if it were a firebrand. Two of the figures halted. The third was taller than the others. His hair was long and gleaming, and on his helm was a crown. In one hand he held a long sword, and in the other a knife. Both the knife and the hand that held it glowed with a pale light. He sprang forward and bore down on Frodo. At that moment, Frodo threw himself forward on the ground. And he heard himself crying aloud, "O Elbreth, Gathoniel!" That's Elvish. And at the same time, he struck at the feet of the enemy. A shrill cry rang out in the night, and he felt a pain like a dart of poisoned ice pierce his left shoulder. Even as he swooned, he caught, as through a swirling mist, a glimpse of Strider leaping out of the darkness with a flaming brand of wood in either hand. With a last effort, dropping his sword, Frodo slipped the ring from his finger and closed his right hand tight upon it. So that's their first encounter, and he's been wounded. And they're forever saying these great things as they whip out a sword. Oh, Elbereth, Gathoniel, which goes back in the history of the Elder. Oh, they'll say something. They all have something to say. They just don't draw their sword and they just go. They have either they recite a poem while the enemy waits and looks at his watch, and or they have these great slogans. which I think is really neat. And not only do the trees have names, but the sword has a name. They're, as in days of war, you named your shield, you know, you named your horse, you named your lance, you named your dagger. I think that's good. I think we live in kind of an unfortunate jaded age where we give big cars names, but we don't need to name anything else. When I lived on the farm, all our cows had, we only had about 12 cows, so it was easy to name them. My dad tried to name the chickens once, and they were all white chickens, so he almost had a nervous breakdown. Keep them apart. Well, that's where we are, and they're having their adventure early. And I obviously can't tell you all about the book because it would spoil it for you anyway. I mentioned language. Let me just read a passage just to give you an idea about the language part and how powerful it can be. How about a comment from you Tolkien lovers?
A what?
A comment. Do you have anything to add at this point?
There is one thing that, I don't know if it's in the introduction of this book, but in the newer publication, a guy is talking and he says it's not Tolkien that you praise when you read the book. It's like, you know, you're not thinking, well, he's a fine author when you read it. You're so involved in the story that, you know, that Middle Earth is somewhere. It's
yes.
not a fictitious book
yes.
when you're reading it. It's a very real thing.
Yes, right. Would you agree with that?
Yeah.
That Middle Earth is real?
I could never figure out, is Middle Earth supposed to be somewhere? I mean, is it supposed to be at a certain time?
Yes. But where?
But we don't know.
No.
It's just there.
Yeah. Would you agree with that? That while you're reading it, it's not a fantasy, right? It's real.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Jeff, what year did you write that piece?
Oh, I forgot.
I mean, it sounds so
30s.
30s.
Because they're all black and
shiny. Yeah. Yeah.
And then when you said the black figure had a white face, I was really relieved.
Yeah.
I think it was from the late 30s.
I mean, that's racist.
It was during World War III.
Yes, 30s, yeah, we're in World War, getting in the late 30s, middle 30s, started writing them early 30s.
Backwards in a way.
Yeah, yeah.
Contemporaneous with the time it's written? Is it supposed to be happening now?
Well, that's a good point.
You don't know.
Tolkien says not particularly. In fact, he's at great pains sometimes to say, don't look for any allegory in this.
Yeah.
The War of the Rings is not World War I, nor is it World War II. Gandalf does not symbolize all that's good, and he goes on and on. But I think you have to take that with a little salt. Any author should have the right to say, this is what I meant, and if you want to read it as a story, jolly well read it as a story, and forget all the symbolism. I must admit I appreciate that, because I don't like allegory very much. I don't have a whole lot of patience with allegory. I remember in grad school when I read Pilgrim's Progress, I was really in trouble. And the Fairy Queen, I had more trouble. But once he said that, I think it's fair game to read what you want to read into it, as long as you do it intelligently. You can't read the Lord of the Rings without seeing good versus evil, without seeing Gandalf and Frodo and Bilbo as standing for people who are decent and want to eat good food and work hard and enjoy good living and trees and flowers. And you can't see Sauron as anything but the opposite of goodness, whether he's a mysterious evil thing or a real flesh and blood person. It's the clash of forces against people who want to live and help their neighbor and be good against all the darkness of the world, whether it be spiritually or mentally and the whole thing. And you can get into these long, involved discussions out there. And Tolkien says, no, it's none of that. It's just a story. Mm. Well, there you are. And I'm not going to argue either side, because I think you ought to... It's like... Yeah, go ahead.
Well, do you think it's possible for somebody to make that up out of their imagination with nothing else? Or could it be there's something
there? All right, very briefly, I think it's possible to do exactly that. And yet, on the other hand, it's not, because Tolkien had read everything, and was a very brilliant man. So he would be the last to say, oh, I've made that out of my head, because obviously the names, orcs and other names, lots of these names come from Scandinavian sagas and Icelandic things, and all, you can see names cropping, Old English, Beowulf and things, a lot of things. So no, he didn't make it up just out of whole cloth, just by himself. But he was sincere when he said, it's just a story, and I don't mean it to mean anything. But any kind of literature art, it seems to me, that the minute you write a poem or you write a story, you're the only one that knows what that means. You compose something and it's your thing. But the minute people read the poem or read the story or listen to music, they're the ones who interpret it, right? Sure. We read a poem or a story, it's ours. And if I write a religious poem and somebody reads that and says, hey, that's not a religious poem. That's a good poem, but it's not religious. It's no good for me to say, yes, it is. It's only religious because I say it's religious. Well, that's the paradox of art, I think. One of the many paradoxes, because obviously the person who wrote it, the person who sculpted the wood, who wrote the music, they are in the position to say what it means. On the other hand, you go into a museum and you can't forever be asking the curator, what does this mean? Right? And when you touch the wood sculpture, watch the dance, or listen to the symphony, your mind goes in a million directions, right? And the music is yours. Never mind what Berlioz meant. For now, it's yours. So I think there's a paradox in all of art and literature like that. And I'd like to take that just one step further briefly. I think there's a third paradox, that once you write something, it belongs to you because you're the writer of it. Once you read it, it belongs to you because now it's yours. But thirdly, it doesn't belong wholly to either the creator or the person who listens. Some of it's just glimmering right in the middle, caught between the creator and the listener, the toucher, the feeler. And so neither myself nor you completely own what it is it has been created. It owns itself. I can't go in any further because I don't understand what that means, except I've always intuitively felt that art was like that. There's some mystery there that can't at last be explained away by either you or myself.
One of the fun things about the Tolkien stuff is once you get out of the Shire country, he builds you up to a lot of levels of intensity. It's a journey, so it's real linear, and he's got to keep topping himself in terms of the skirmishes, the adventures that happen. But his comic relief has a very neat quality about it. A character like Samwise, who I guess when I start talking about my favorite characters, Samwise always ends up as being one of my great favorites, who's a clown, and he's often there with comic relief. He's forgotten his favorite pot to cook with or whatever. And so the comic relief is very round, earthy, kind of lusty quality about it. And you're really ready for it when it happens. They've just finished with something or something, you know, something's very dangerous is coming up. Mm-hmm. But Samwise is one of the neat kind of comic relief characters. He's also one of the heavy philosophers in a little kind of homespun way. And his offhand and kind of dialogue within himself.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Good point. Sam is a marvelous guy. Right, he's always forgetting his rope. And they're always having to scale precipices or cross chasms or jump this and that. He says, I've forgotten my rope, Mr. Frodo. He says, you never know when you might need a bit of rope. And they get to Galadriel and Lothlórien. Yeah. And he gets this beautiful elvish rope made by the elves, which coils so neatly, and you can tuck it in your pack, and it's very soft. And he's always talking about this, as you say, very homey rope. I left Los Angeles last week. I said, tucked in a bit of rope, thinking you'd never know when you might need it. All right, here's a. It's in my car, 25 miles. But I've got it, you know. Should I have to cross a chasm going over Stevens Pass, I can whip it out.
Point? I was just going to say there's a book by Kilby who spent a lot of time with Tolkien. And one of Tolkien himself actually criticized Samwise. So he was an obnoxious.
Is that right? Yeah, Tolkien got very private about that, yeah. There is, I've forgotten the name, several books, obviously, dissertations now, unfortunately, and the whole thing. Well, I don't talk about that.
He's still alive?
No, he died not too many years ago.
73?
Okay, yeah, thank you. Listen to the language. They're going to a place called Helm's Gate, or Helm's Deep, in a crevice, or up a pass, a draw, arroyo, whatever you call it, into the mountains. And there's a fortress there, but listen to this description. At Helm's Gate, before the mouth of the deep, there was a heel of rock thrust outward by the northern cliff. There upon its spur stood high walls of ancient stone, and within them was a lofty tower. Men said that in the far-off days of the glory of Gondor, the sea kings had built here this fastness with the hands of giants. The Hornburg it is called, for a trumpet sounded upon the tower, echoed in the deep behind, as if armies long forgotten were issuing to war from caves beneath the hills. A wall, too, the men of old had made from the Hornburg to the southern cliff, barring the entrance to the gorge. Beneath it, by a wide covert, the deeping stream passed out, About the feet of the Horn Rock it wound and flowed then in a gully through the midst of the wide green gore, sloping gently down to Helm's Gate to Helm's Dyke. Thence it fell into the deeping combe and out to the Westfold Vale. There in the Hornburg at Helm's Gate, Erkenbrand, master of Westfold on the borders of the Mark, now dwelt. As the days darkened with threat of war, being wise, he had repaired the wall and made the fastness strong. There's that marvelous flow of that language, none of which you need to understand, particularly for this purpose. But you just get caught up. It's like Hopkins in some ways. There's a lot of poems by Hopkins that I have not taken the time to really do, but I love the language. It just picks you up and carries you along with it. And this is one of those times. Well, I could go on and on, but we just don't have time. Frodo meets all kinds of dangers and meets all kinds. One of the nastiest characters is Gollum, a nasty little hobbit who's gone sour. And he's evil, and he just kind of gurgles and gargles in his throat, and his eyes bulge out because he can't stand the sun anymore. He lives under tunnels under mountains. He has long, grasping fingers. And he hates the hobbits because he had the ring. And through some trickery and games in the Hobbit, Frodo has it now. So he's following the questers, trying to get the ring, and he's always saying, "Nasty hobbits, nasty hobbits." And he's always clicking his fingers and gnashing his teeth. And Tolkien has a brilliant description of him going into brackish pools where slimy fish are, and he'll grab one of those and munch the bones and always gnaw and say, "Nasty hobbits." He's a horrible creature. And he's always following them. And they're going down a river in a boat, and you see little two eyeballs floating. He's floating after them and padding on soft feet. And so there's all kinds of things going on. And the orcs are another thing that I didn't... And the ants are these huge tree people that are just... some people think that the Ents is Tolkien's most original contribution and invention. So you could just talk forever about the elements in this book and how they all at last come together to form within this context of the folk epic, folk myth quest, and what they have to do with it, until finally you arrive at the summit where Frodo has to perform his deed. And I'll just leave you there because I don't like to be told too much when I read a book, but I hope to whet your appetite. Yeah.
Any words about Silmarillion?
Maybe you've read Silmarillion twice, did you say? Mm-hmm. Why don't you answer that? I read half of Silmarillion and I was rather disappointed, so I decided to put it down and try to save it for a while.
What was it?
What do you think of it?
Oh, well, I read it twice because the first time it's kind of hard to understand what's going on. He jumps spots once in a while and he'll go back to space, but you really got to read it through again to understand what's really happening, all that's going on.
It takes tremendous history. It goes back and explain everything that went before.
It's more like a textbook than a... although there are one or two stories in there that are just excellent. There's one in particular of a man and an elven woman, or whatever you want to call them, who get together and they go against the guy that was before Sauron, who was the truly evil one. And it's a fantastic story. Fantastic. It's a small quest type thing. It's fantastic. But the rest of it is just, there's a lot of information in there. And it's kind of mind-boggling after reading it a few times that you pick up a lot out of the Lord of the Rings, and a lot of the history behind the Lord of the Rings out of it. So it's interesting. I think you really almost have to be a Tolkien freak to really enjoy it, though.
My brother said it's more like a history book than a story.
Yes?
I think it's sort of really striking out more the mythology than anything else. Uh-huh. Like a Greek mythology, you know, like Tolkien's about all the gods and the gods get together, and then you've got their relationships with men and elves. And it's like way back to the beginning.
Uh-huh. Yes?
I think it would have been better if you would have published Silmarillion first, because it just provides so much background to the story, all these names and terminologies. Yeah. You really have to force yourself to concentrate when first reading the book, I think.
Yeah.
First reading of the trilogy.
The world's excuse me.
Silmarillion really establishes a lot of the basic definitions for the terms.
The worlds he creates are enormous. So when you at last get into the book, it's a tremendous adventure story, but keep in mind he invents Elvish language. He invents this language and that language and the history. And as a historian, as a person dealing with words and language and linguistics, it's absolutely enormous. So you can read it on different kinds of levels. So I hope you all read it. And you didn't remind me to
pass out your paper.
Hey, listen, this has nothing to do with Lord of the Rings, but people have asked me to do this, and I keep forgetting. Last summer, Rich Kammerer, one of the artists in the village here, and I led a tour to Europe and Greece and Jerusalem and for 6 weeks, and it was so successful. We had a number of people from Holden Village, and so they asked that if you do it again, please get a brochure. So I'm leading the same tour next summer, and I'm just going to pass out these brochures, and if you're interested, fine. If you're not, pass them on to somebody else. Thanks for coming. I hope you read Tolkien.
I want to ask you something.